This week, Welton spoke with Michael McRae, author of the recent book, I Am Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World.
Alienation, division, anger, hatred. These are terms ever more frequently applied to our nation today. And as we fearfully look at what the next manifestations of these intense emotions might be in our land, it is essential that we give up the notion that we are unique in being confronted with them. Indeed, that we give up even the notion that we are unique in confronting them in what is, by any standard, an age of peace and prosperity. Michael, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
How long have you been engaged in the work of conflict resolution?
Well, I got my master's in conflict resolution in 2012, living in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and then have been traveling in the Middle East since I was 10. So in some ways have been around these issues for a while, but professionally I've been thinking about it for about 8 or 9 years.
Hmm. In the book, you present moving stories of people who rose above incredible suffering to see the humanity in each other. Could you start with just telling us one favorite example?
Yeah. So one of the stories that stuck out to me is one that I based the title of the book on, which is called I Am Not Your Enemy. And the chapter title is called I've Just Met the Enemy. It's the story of Jo Barry, who's an English woman whose father was murdered by an IRA bomber. Her father was a member of the British Parliament. IRA was an Irish paramilitary group fighting against the British. And her dad was killed in a bomb. And for years, Jo struggled with what to do with that, as anyone would. But in 2000, when the Good Friday Accords had been signed and a lot of the political prisoners were released, she had the chance to actually meet Patrick McGee, the man that planted the bomb that killed her father. And they were able to meet in a room, have a conversation that started out kind of poorly, where Patrick was justifying a lot of what he had done, a lot of the violence that he had committed, and kind of political justifications, and Jo was just getting tired of hearing it. And so she was about to leave the room when Patrick then said, you know what, I don't actually know what to say anymore. I think what I need to do is to hear your rage and to know what you feel, how you see this. And it changed the whole course of their conversation. Mm-hmm. And they ended up meeting many times after that and building what Jo would call a real friendship, where she was able to say, I obviously don't agree with Patrick's decision, political decision to kill my father. But I can imagine, had I grown up where he grew up in Northern Ireland with his stories and his pain, his experiences, that I might have been driven to do the same thing. And so they now spend a lot of their professional life traveling the world together, speaking on forgiveness and reconciliation. And so it was an actual case of somebody who met their enemy, an actual real world enemy. They exist and was able to find a way not just to sit in the same room, but actually to create some kind of friendship with them because of the practice of empathy.
Yeah. Good grief. That is so inspiring and insightful. Will you tell us another story?
So, yeah, there was another case of two men. It's where the book ends. Rami El-Hanan and Bassam Aramin. Rami is an Israeli father whose father survived Auschwitz, but whose daughter didn't survive her 14th birthday. Her name was Smadar, and she was killed in Jerusalem by a Palestinian suicide bomber. And then Bassam Aramin is a Palestinian father whose daughter, Abir, was 10 years old when she was shot in the back of the head by an Israeli soldier on her way home from school and killed. And they both experienced the power of grief as a nuclear energy that could lead them in one of two directions, one being the perpetuation of grief on other people. There's a phrase that trauma that is not transformed is transferred, that it is an energy, and that when we do not find a way to turn it into something that can help us, we will only continue to perpetuate harm. And this is the decision that they were faced with. What do we do with this catastrophic grief that we feel? And so what they decided they had to do was to do everything within their power to make sure that other people did not experience the same pain that they did. That instead that they say, you know, look, we've paid the highest price possible. We're the ones, if anyone has a right to keep this conflict going, it's us. We're the ones that have lost our children. but it's precisely because of this shared pain that we have a shared responsibility now to work toward a peaceful resolution to this conflict and some kind of equity and justice. Mm-hmm. And so they joined an organization called the Parent Circle, which is Israeli and Palestinian bereaved family members who were using the shared bitterness of their tears, the shared sense of loss and grief, as a sense of common ground for working towards some kind of shared country.
Hmm. Michael, as you look at the stories that you share in the book, are there common themes that emerge? And by that I mean themes that either seem most dangerous in the escalation of conflict, as well as themes to what finally breaks that cycle across different cultures and communities?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think some of the commonalities in terms of what perpetuate conflict are unaddressed grievances. You know, people have legitimate grievances, fear, historical wounds. There was often a sense to which a lot of these historical grievances are kept alive through the myths and the stories that are told about the other, that we don't have what we need or we are under attack because of them. And so there's a really clear target for animosity. And that there was this sense of dehumanization, that it is in the interest of the perpetuation of conflict to make the other as simple and as uninteresting and as unnuanced as possible, because humans are complex. And so when you can make someone not complex and just say, well, they are, you know, terrorists, they are occupiers, they are just police, they are X, Y, and Z, it becomes much easier to kind of narrow in your firepower.
Yeah.
So I saw those a lot. Basically, the power of stories, which is my focus. I work in storytelling and peace building, so the power of stories to perpetuate that. But then I also saw the power of stories to heal, that what was transformative in almost all the stories that I encountered was when somebody who had othered this group, who had an enemy in their mind, it was almost always in their imagination, you know, that they imagined a story about this person. They were writing this narrative about their enemy in their own mind. And what changed for them was when they actually met the person, when they met the other, when they sat down, when they were actually able to hear the stories, which doesn't always solve it. But I've often said that in my mind, the way we dismantle enemies is three ways. One, we get proximate. We actually have to get closer to the thing that we're afraid of, that we hate. We have to be humble. We have to actually wonder in our minds, has it occurred to us that we might have been wrong about the other? And then that has to lead us into curiosity. We must actually want to know something beyond what we have felt like we know. And that those three things, proximity, humility, and curiosity, showed up in all the stories of transformation that I encountered on my travels.
Hmm. If you could get leaders both here and abroad to sit and listen to you right now, leaders who are using provocative tactics that divide and disturb, that inflame fear and anger, leaders both secular and religious, Michael, what would you say to them as a warning?
I would say that I don't actually know what I would say. My gut at the moment is saying, I would want to say as a warning, we are headed toward the death of many people that we care about, that we're responsible for, that we love. I think we're on the verge of armed conflict in the United States, and I think a lot of people are going to die. And I would want that to be a warning. And then as an encouragement to say, despite the clear differences that we have, there is, I think, a sense of shared need. You know, in conflict resolution theory, there's something called the Penn diagram, which is basically a pyramid. And at the top, the smallest piece of the pyramid is called positions. The middle portion is called interests. And the largest portion at the very bottom of the pyramid is needs. And the idea is that when we get into conflict, usually what we do is we argue our positions. Well, we need to defund the police, or no, police need to be everywhere, or we need to be here, and no, we need to be there. Whatever it might be, we argue positions. And that's the smallest piece of what we have in common. But that, in fact, when we can get down to the level of needs, there's a lot more opportunity for connection. And so even here in the United States, I think we have this sense to which a shared need is the need to, like, the need to protect what we have, the need to protect our sense of self, our belonging, and our security. Because I think on all sides of this, there is a fear that what we have, what we cherish, what we love is going to be taken from us, whether that's a black family afraid of a police officer who might kill their child, or whether it's a white person being afraid that their way of life or their sense of identity is under attack and it's all going to be taken from them. The need is, in fact, the same, though it's manifesting in very radically different positions.
Does that mean that you see in the current crisis in our nation a sign, a hopeful sign, or did I just misunderstand that, or are we really at a moment carooning toward a cliff that we can't stop?
There's a sense to which I think, I mean, I guess I nuance it slightly. My analysis of what's happening in the United States is that I think we are primed for armed conflict. I don't think we're unique in the world, as you were saying at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I've spent time in Rwanda, South Africa, Israel, Palestine, Northern Ireland, and places where people thought it won't happen here, it happens there. And I think it can happen here. It's not to say that I think it's going to, but I think we're primed for it. So there is a sense to which I do feel fear about what's coming and the amount of weapons that are there, the amount of polarizations that that exist. And at the same time, I think part of the hope for me lies in the fact that I don't know that there's ever been as many people mobilized in service of a movement for social justice and equality than right now in the United States, I mean, within our country at least, that there is something hopeful about the diversity of people marching, the diversity of people taking to the streets. You know, the fact that the National Basketball Association, the NBA, has Black Lives Matter and is kneeling, and all these things that are just very public that are new in a sense. And I think that is encouraging to me. And that's sitting side by side with the reality that we may still have armed conflict.
I wish, before we go, that you would tell our listeners what you really want them to know and understand about the stories that you're telling in this book.
Mm. I think what I took away from the stories that I gathered in I Am Not Your Enemy is that enemies are real. That terrible pain can find us at any time, that none of us are fully safe from the difficulties of conflict and violence. And yet, even in the worst experiences of our lives, the worst moments, there are ways out of violence. There is the possibility of cultivating an imagination that sees the world beyond the idea of enemies, that trauma can actually be transformed. It doesn't have to be transferred. And that through the power of empathy, of trying to imagine the narrative and life of another, the practice of getting proximate, the practice of being humble, that we actually can find a way to live together without violence.
Hmm. One other question. Would you talk for just a minute about the study guide that is available in conjunction with this book, and how is that intended to be used and by whom?
Yeah, so I wrote a discussion guide to I Am Not Your Enemy, which is available through my website. You can go to michaelmcrae.com and subscribe to the website, and you'll be sent the discussion guide. And it's meant to be used really by anyone. You can use it as a way to do self-reflection, read through the book, answer questions from each chapter. It was kind of designed really for small groups, I guess, whether that's a small group of people that you go to work with, that you worship with, or just a group of friends that you get together. But it's intended to spark discussion that has no right or wrong answer to it, really open-ended discussion around what do we do with these themes? How do we make sense of the purpose of dialogue? How do we deal with trauma? And to focus on where does it show up in your community? Because I told stories from abroad, but the purpose was to help us see with a new focus the problems and possibilities in our own small corners of the world. And so I think it does us very little good to simply say, well, what does this mean in Israel and Palestine? The question for me, living in Nashville, Tennessee, is what does Israel-Palestine teach me about how I should show up in Nashville, Tennessee? And so that's what I hope people will do with the study guide.
Michael McRae is an author, facilitator, story practitioner, conflict mediator, and educator. Michael, thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Happy to be here. Really grateful for the invitation.
Michael McRae is the author of the important book, I Am Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World.